By a happy coincidence, a researcher in Jerusalem, Dr. Nachman Avigad, was able to announce just 2 days before Hanukkah this week that the earliest known full-size representation of the menorah had been unearthed. It had been found incised into a plaster wall in a building about 100 yards from the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, a layer which indicates that it had been placed there by some artisan during the first half of the first century before the Common Era. It is about 2,030, 2,040 years ago, 130 or 140 years before the destruction of the temple. Now, the representation of the menorah is a very common one in ancient times. We find it in the mosaic floors of any number of Palestinian synagogues. We find it in the beautiful frescoes of the 3rd century synagogue in Syria, Dura Europus, above the niche in which they kept their sacred Torah. One of the most resplendent of the images is the golden outline or silhouette of a menorah. And many of the Jews of the Roman world were buried in sarcophagi which had embossed on them or incised into them the silhouette of the menorah. But all of these representations are posterior to the destruction of the temple. All of them were made after 70 of the Common Era, after the Roman legions razed and destroyed the temple. And they are either conventional representations of the menorah or artistic reproductions done by verbal descriptions. The only earlier outlines of the menorah that we have appear on some very small Hasmonean copper coins, which had embossed on one side the menorah, but time has not dealt kindly with these coins, and for the most, the image, the silhouette, has been erased or eradicated. The representation of the menorah, which is most familiar to us, which was used by the State of Israel as the base of its shield, comes from the Arch of Titus in Rome, the Victory Arch, erected by the general, later to become Caesar of the Roman Empire, who commanded the troops that breached the walls of Jerusalem and fired the temple and leveled it to the ground. And you see in one of the panels of this great triumphal arch of this Roman conqueror, Judean soldiers, now captives, walking in his victory procession, carrying aloft the various implements and instruments which were used in the temple, all of them precious, all of them golden. And highest among these is a menorah, being carried aloft by one of the men. It's a rather thick-set, rather squat candelabra, with three arms rising upward and outward on each side, and a central stem, all of it culminating, each of the arms and the stem culminating in a vessel which obviously held the oil and the wick, where the burning of the light took place, all of it resting on a hexagonal two-tiered base into which there were incised, according to this representation, any number of mythological animals. An eagle carrying aloft a Roman wreath, two sea monsters looking at each other, the traditional lions of the Middle East, and also an object very much like the zodiac sign of Capricorn. Now, scholars have questioned this particular representation of the menorah, in part because it was done by a Roman sculptor who may or may not have seen the original menorah, in part because it was obviously done to accentuate the weight of the gold from which the menorah was made, the value of the booty which Titus had taken, and in part because of the presence on the base of the menorah of these animals, which so patently violate the second commandment, "Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, nor any manner of likeness of anything that is in the heavens above, or the earth beneath, or the waters under the earth." And they've been interested to know exactly what the menorah looked like, and now apparently we do know. The menorah which has been found is far taller, its arms are more graceful, it is still seven lighted, three arms on each side of the central base. The base does have decoration on it, but from the verbal description which has come to us this last week, it is simply a decorative design rather than the representation of animal figures. And there are on it not the knobs from the Arch of Titus, but actual florets, rosettes, three flower-like objects on each arm and four of these objects on each stem. Now, what has all of this to do with Hanukkah? It's all very interesting, Rabbi, and it's all very archaeological. But what has it got to do with Hanukkah? Simply this, that the light which Judah the Maccabee rekindled in the temple 165 years before the Common Era was this menorah. Now the menorah had existed in the temple in the days of King Solomon, and it had a traditional form. This form was prescribed by the biblical text. It was believed to have been revealed by God to Moses and particularly to Bezalel, the master smith of the ancient Israelites. We read in the 38th chapter of the book of Exodus that he, Bezalel, made the menorah of pure gold. He made the menorah, its base and its shaft of hammered work, its cup, its calyxes, the petals, were all of one piece with it. Six branches issued from its sides, three branches from one side of the menorah and three branches from the other side. There are three cups shaped like almond blossoms, each with petals on one branch, and there were three cups shaped like almond branches with petals on the next branch, so that all six branches issuing from the menorah had petals on them. Now on the menorah itself and the stem, there were four cups shaped like almond blossoms, each with its petals. One of these cups, almond blossom cups, for one piece with, made of one piece with a pair of branches, and one of one piece with it, and upon the second pair of branches, another of these almond blossoms. He made these seven lamps, its tongs and fire pans of pure gold. He made it, the menorah, and all its furnishings out of a talent of pure gold. Now, obviously, this rich and sacred light which burned eternally in the temple was the most precious thing. And it remained in Solomon's temple until 586 of the Common Era, when the Babylonians took it as loot. And when Ezra came back to rebuild the temple, he reestablished a menorah patterned after the first. And this was in fact looted in the year 168 of the Common Era by Antiochus Epiphanes, the villain of the Hanukkah story. Antiochus not only proscribed the Hebrew faith, ordered that the Jews profane the Sabbath, ordered that a statue of Zeus Olympius be raised in the temple in Jerusalem, but he took from the temple all of its treasure, all of its gold and all of its silver and all of its precious metal. He took them and burnt them down, melted them down, and used them as money to pay his troops and his courtiers. So among the things that Judah the Maccabee and his followers did when they refurbished and purified the temple in 165 after their victory was to build again a menorah and to light it again. And it's an image of that menorah which has been found now incised in plaster in a wall in Jerusalem. Now what is a menorah? Why is it so precious? What did it stand for in our tradition? This great tall seven-branch candelabra was really the symbol of the temple. It stood in the Holy of Holies, just behind the ark, which was the entrance to it. It was the one light in the shadow of this dark room, where the priest went once a year on the Day of Atonement to ask God forgiveness for his sins and for the sins of the whole people. It burnt eternally. It was trimmed. More oil was put into it each day. There was a special three-tiered ladder in the temple which the priests climbed to see to attend to the menorah. Every form on the menorah and the menorah itself was believed to teach man about God and about God's control power in this world. Because this was not a ritual object devised by the ingenuity of some artist. God himself had designed the first menorah, and he designed it for a purpose. What was this purpose? Why lights? Light is a symbol of faith. Light rises from man to God. Light is a symbol of enlightenment, of learning. Light is a symbol that in the darkness which is the world, God had been kind enough and gracious enough to man to give some enlightenment, to teach man the way that he must go. Hiner mitzvah, the Torah or, the Bible says, for the commandment is a light and the Torah is a lamp, a menorah. All around us, when we are born, there is darkness and there is confusion and there are shadows. And we would be hard-pressed, our fathers felt, to know which way to go, which values to make ours, if the commandments, if the Torah had not been revealed. God has given us enlightenment, and the menorah burnt as a symbol of that enlightenment. But there was more to it than this. Every part of the menorah had its meaning. The whole was built in the shape of a tree, the stem, the branches, the buds, the blossoms. The tree of life, Eitz Chaim. God gives life and God gives the light. The seven branches represented all of creation, all of visible creation, the 7 days of the week, the seven great circles of the planets in the heavens, the seven great spheres which the ancients believed were the seven circuits in the heavens. Seven represented God's creative power. The first sentence of the Bible, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, has seven words in it. Bereshit, bara, Elohim, et hashamayim, et haaretz. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. All of God's creative majesty and might was somehow imprinted in and taught by the menorah. The menorah burnt in the darkness, burnt always. The shadows were dispelled by the light. There's always shadow to life. There's always the light of faith and always the light of learning. And I'm not simply giving to you a 20th century romantic understanding of the menorah. Let me quote to you an interpretation of it by the fine Alexandrian philosopher Philo, who lived while the temple was still in existence. And this is what he says of the menorah. He commands, that is God, that the lamps on the sacred menorah within the veil should be kept burning from evening till early morning. He has several objects in this. One is that the holy places should be illumined when the daylight leaves them, and thus remain ever exempt from darkness, and this resembling the stars. For they, when the sun has set, display their own light, and do not forsake their place in the cosmic order. God is in the darkness and the night, as well as in the daytime. The second object was that at nighttime also some rites of this kind, some rites similar to those of the daytime, should be performed for the service of God, and that no time or season should omit its thanksgiving. And to show our thankfulness, the sacrificial offering, for sacrificial it may properly be called, this offering most suitable and appropriate to the night, for it is the radiance of that most sacred light in the inner shrine. And this is a third reason, and a very cogent one, that only in our waking hours do we experience blessing, but also in our slumbers. For God, the bountiful, has provided our mortal race with a great support in the form of sleep, whereby both body and soul are benefited. The body is relaxed from the labors of the day. The soul relaxes its anxious cares and retreats into itself, away from the press and clamor of the senses, and can then, if at no other time, enjoy privacy and commune with itself. Rightly, therefore, did the law determine so to apportion with the thank offering that thankfulness be expressed for our waking time at the altar and for our sleeping time by the light. The menorah, then, was one of the most sacred objects within our tradition. It bespoke God's creative power. It bespoke God's constancy, his power to deliver, his power to redeem, his power to protect. It was right and appropriate that it be the object which Judah lit at that first service of dedication. For God again had dispelled the darkness. God again had brought light. And so this week, all of us with our children drew around a menorah, not the seven-branched menorah of the temple, but a nine-branched menorah, which was symbolic of a miracle which took place after the lighting of that first lamp. And we sang the songs of Hanukkah about God's redemptive power, how God has dispelled the night and kept our people alive and graced civilization with some new capacity for survival. And as we did so, we thought of the ancient victory. We rejoiced in the deliverance of the few from the many. We gave our children presents to express our thankfulness for the larger gifts. But I wonder how many of us would really, if we had been alive 21 centuries ago, how many of us would really have stood there that ancient day with Judah and with the Maccabees? How many of us would have enlisted with him and fought with him and died for him? And how many of us would have found good reason to be elsewhere, to be at home, to be apart? There were many who were not part of the Maccabees' successful rebellion. We were taught about Hanukkah in the Sunday school as a single-line story. There was the villain Antiochus Epiphanes. He's a madman. They called him Epimanes, the mad one. And he determines, for reasons best known to himself, to enforce thought control upon his empire. And he orders that all people bow down and bend the knee to Zeus Olympius, his patron god, of whom he was the incarnation. And all the people bowed down. There was no difficulty for polytheists to bow to another god. Only the Jews refused, or at least some of them, refused to bow down. And he became angry and he prohibited the entire faith, the Sabbath and circumcision and the dietary laws and the teaching of the tradition. And so the Jews rose in rebellion. And after 3 years of guerrilla war, the Maccabees came to the temple, conquered it from the Assyrian Greeks, purged it, cleansed it, and dedicated it anew to God. And so we sing Rock of Ages, Let Our Song, and so on. But the interesting part of the story, the part we often forget, is that Judah and his band were never more than a minority within Israel. When they first took to the mountains, we read the story today. The Syrian officers comes to this little outpost town, Modin, and what does he say? All through Israel, all through Judea, there have been those who have bowed down. The citizens of Jerusalem have agreed to accept the patron god of your emperor. What's the matter? Why don't you join with the many? There are many who, for various reasons, found it expedient or advantageous to bow to the will of Antiochus. And there were the timid, the fearful, the weak, those who were concerned to protect their families and their lives. They didn't go into the hills with Judah the Maccabee. Perhaps they gave his soldiers bread and food when they came by. They were perhaps sympathetic. Great revolutions, great freedoms are not won by the timid nor by the weak. The very day that the temple was rededicated, the very day that we commemorate this week, the 25th of Kislev, 165 before the Common Era, just a few hundred yards from the temple where the menorah was rekindled, there was a great fortress. It was called the Acra. It had been built by the first Seleucus emperor, the first emperor of the Syrian Greeks, who had conquered Judea, as the fortress stronghold by which he would control Jerusalem. It had walls that were 20 feet thick. It was 5 stories tall, a great height for a building in those days. And inside those walls were hundreds of Judeans, whom Judah had not conquered, whom he had besieged, who were to remain within the Agra in an open opposition for a decade after Judah had reconquered Jerusalem. Who was there? Who had fought Judah? Who were these Judeans who were opposed to Hanukkah? In the first instance, they were the establishment. They were the rich, the office holders, the powerful, all who had done business with and gotten promotion from the Syrians. All those who had found 100 diplomatic ways to say, if the emperor orders us to do this, we must do it. Why make waves? we go and oppose the emperor, he will depose us. He will throw us into jail. What have we to gain? Let's find a way to get along and to go along. And it's been the history of many communities that when the very challenge to their life's existence has taken place, those who are their titular heads, whose office depends upon the agreement of a power outside the communities, have found that they are caught between the upper and the nether millstone, between the needs of the people and the demands of the overlord. If you are empowered by one who lords it over your people, you are responsible to him ultimately, rather than to your own. And in the Agra, there were, among others, the great high priest, the very man whose temple had been defiled. And this high priest who had brought his office, so defiled the high priesthood that he had brought his office from the Syrian generals, he saw nothing wrong in the idol of Zeus Olympius and the offering of abominations of the swine upon the altar. After all, he was a liberal man. He was a sophisticated gentleman. He looked about him at all the other temples of all the other faiths in the ancient Middle East, and he said, why not? Everyone does it. Why shouldn't we? Why should we be so provincial, so parochial? Oh, yes, the commandments say that we shouldn't, but you can always interpret the commandments. God was, after all, talking to a people 1,000 years ago rather than our own day. The high priest was in the Agra. He, too, had found reason to do business with the emperor. And all of the smart set, all of the very sophisticated in Jerusalem were either in this citadel or had fled the country. All those who had said, the Greek culture is the advanced culture, it is the liberated culture, it is the culture of the times, let us be Greek. Why should we be people of a small outpost with none of the amenities of life, none of the sensitivities? Why? What is wrong with displaying and exhibiting ourselves naked in the games? The Greeks do it. Why should we allow the old rules of modesty, which seem so important to our fathers and to our mothers, to remain powerful among us? Why should we not bring into Jerusalem the Greek theater with its teachings of fate, of an implacable destiny? Why should we not engage in the kind of sexual relationships favored by the Greeks? Why should we be such prudes just because our fathers were? Here are these people who have conquered half the world. Surely their civilization is a glorious one and it ought to become ours. And then at Agra also, you had any number of people who were simply followers, who simply go where the power is, go where the action is. They are as moths to the flame. One of the things we tend to forget about the Maccabean revolt is that it was not only a popular revolt, a war of national liberation against an oppressor, but it was also a civil war. For a dozen years before, great class divisions had appeared in the Judean community between the rich and the favored and the privileged and the positioned and the powerful and the status seeker and the sophisticate on the one hand and the people on the other. Between the people who said, Naaseh kagoyim, let us do like all those about us do. Their ways cannot be Bulgarian simply because they seem different to us. Their ways are the ways of the conqueror. Their ways are the ways of power. We must keep our eye on the real thing, which is making out and making do. And those who said, there is another way, the ancient way, the traditional way, the religious way. And it involves disciplines of family, disciplines of person, restrictions on one's freedom of action, restrictions on one's business dealings, which we must not cast aside. The hard-headed businessman 2,100 years ago said, let's throw over these old dietary rules, these old rules of purity. They stand in my way from getting ahead. I can't invite the non-Jew to my home, and he can't invite me to his because of the these old rules. Let's do away with them. And the office holder said, let my child go to the gymnasium, to the great university established by the Greek, whose graduates determine the establishment of a Greek community. Why should he be raised in a Jewish school, in a yeshiva? Let him be raised according to the Greek canons. Let him know Greek. The old is past. The old is gone. We live in a new world, and let's be part of it. How many of us would have stood with the Maccabees, with the old against the new? Not many did. And yet, if they had not been obstinate and obdurate, these few, if they had gone with the tinsel and the sophisticate and the bright, with freedom, with liberalism, whatever it meant in those days, not only would Judaism have perished, but with it, the monotheistic traditions of the West, Christianity and Islam. And not only would we not have today the traditional religious forms of the West, but we would not have the basic concept of humanity. For Greece, for all of her philosophic glory, because of her polytheism, because of her belief in many gods, Greeks were never able to see that all men were fundamentally equal, created by the one Father, all tied together in one shared responsibility. To the Greek, there was always the citizen and the barbarian, the barbaros, means literally the ape. There were always those who were meant to rule and those fit only to be ruled. To the Jew, and to the Jew alone in the ancient world, it was, have not we all one Father? Hath not one God created us all? And what battle still remains for us in the 20th century but the battle of humanity? To see to it that all the lines of color and race and creed are crossed by one overarching responsibility to citizenship. We have not yet won the battle whose lights were first lit by the Maccabees of old. But their concept, their courage, their convictions make it possible for us to fight that battle today. Now, there must have been wisdom among those who went with the Assyrians who were imprisoned in the Agra. There is good reason to be prudent, and there is good reason to be open to the world of which we are a part, and not to wall ourselves out from that world. We must not only change ourselves and keep ourselves disciplined, but change the world and help to discipline it. Perhaps that's the reason that we now light our menorah, the nine-branched menorah, no longer the pure menorah of the temple. But whatever the reason, whatever the balance any of us strikes between self-discipline, religious loyalty, involvement in the larger community, whatever balance we strike between the standards which we were taught in our homes and the standards which surge about us, or the lack of standards which surge about us in our society, let us remember ultimately that the Maccabees demand this of those who are their descendants, that they be zealous for the Torah. They be among those who are willing to make the ancient immemorial truths the very substance and core of their lives. And if family, self and dignity of self, and humanity, and justice, and truth, and freedom, and community are truly values which we espouse, we light lights in their honor, then they are values with which we cannot compromise. And though the world about us entice us and encourage us to come out, to give up, to change our ways, on Hanukkah we must say, thank you very much, but no thank you. Ner mitzvah v'torah or. The commandments are a light, and the old, old teachings are my enlightenment. Amen.